Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Hey, thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast at peterbcollins.com. I think this program's going to provoke some arguments. I can just feel it coming on. Vaccination is a very controversial issue. There is a majority that demonizes a minority of people who are skeptical or who resist some vaccination, in some cases all vaccination. And it's led to regulations requiring, mandating people to be vaccinated. That's a little too much for me. In a moment, we'll introduce our guest, Bernice Hausman, to talk about her new book, Anti-Vax. This program's made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions, including Abby McMillan, Margaret Anderson, Joe Carson, Alice Carlson. They all chip in a few bucks a month, and you can do it too. If you're so inclined, visit peterbcollins.com, click on Menu, click on Become a Subscriber. You'll hit the sign-up page, and I think you can take it from there. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, we take on a major controversy here in the United States. Should vaccination be mandatory? And on what basis can parents opt out of some or all vaccinations for their children? It's been contentious in the legislature here in California, and there was a crackdown on conservative Jewish families in New York last year. Our opening music today is called Infected, from an 80s British pop band called The. And I want to confess to listeners that I expect not to please everyone and perhaps offend everyone today with this conversation with Professor Bernice Hausman from the University of Pennsylvania. Her new book is called Anti-Vax, subtitled Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. And, Professor, I imagine that you have encountered angry people on both sides of this debate. How do you maintain your equanimity?
Well, I kind of retreat into a scholarly position, I guess I'd say. And I try to treat the situation anthropologically. I think actually that's a helpful, it's a helpful standpoint for many things in our society today. Instead of getting exercised about the specific issue, I try to back up a little bit and try to figure out what has created a context in which this particular scenario could be occurring.
Well, you really deliver that in the book. And let's begin with a bit of a profile of you. You are a remarkable multidisciplinary academic. You landed at Penn State College of Medicine a couple of years ago after a run at Virginia Tech, where you were in the humanities department as a professor. You chaired the Department of English, and you also have skills in medicine. You taught at the Virginia Tech School of Medicine. So that is a remarkable set of credentials. You've written three books, Changing Sex, about transsexualism, Mother's Milk, about breastfeeding, and this latest book, Anti-Vax. You also come out of a family of medical professionals. Your grandfather was a family doctor, your dad a pathologist. He saw the outcomes, right, of human behavior and things related to vaccination. So that is quite a background that you bring to the coverage that you deliver in this book.
Yeah, it's interesting because at one point I was as an undergraduate student, I was interested in studying medicine, and I decided instead to go for a graduate training in women's studies, which at the time, the mid 1980s, was not particularly easy. But I was able to do so through a program at the University of Iowa, where I was a graduate student, that allowed me to create my own interdisciplinary doctoral program with a supporting committee. And then from there, I basically have been studying medicine ever since I worked on my dissertation in some form or another. So I sort of started that, kind of hooked into the medical humanities, the growing movement in medical humanities. And then when my department at Virginia Tech developed a graduate program in rhetoric, I started to think about my work as a part of that field, medical rhetoric, which is a growing field. And so I was really able to kind of capitalize on my own interests and then sort of growing interest in studying medicine throughout the academy. And then 2 years ago, when this position at Penn State College of Medicine opened up to chair the Department of Humanities, I jumped on it as a great opportunity, mid-career opportunity, to kind of work within academic medicine to study its cultural context and more humanistic attributes.
And I'll confess that I was satisfied with the 4-line, or I guess it's 5-line bio that is on the overleaf of the book. and then I said, you know, there's more to this because she can write.
Thank you.
Because your voice, I mean, the book is fairly personal. You're not afraid to use the pronoun I. But you don't gild the lily, you know, about your academic history and your achievements. So I find it quite impressive. And I want to next just thank you for this book, because I believe that we've seen real extremism coming from the pro-vaccination majority, and there have been some extremist and unforgivable actions and rhetoric coming from the anti-vax community. And you managed to, I think, rise above some of the controversies and offer a really thoughtful look at those who are skeptical of all vaccinations, or who resist the total menu of vaccines that are offered to children today. And I think it's a remarkable accomplishment on your part.
Well, thank you. It's gratifying. That's been one of the most gratifying elements of the public response to the book. I gave a reading at a local bookstore in Harrisburg in June, and I have to admit, I was a little bit concerned, not knowing who would show up, knowing how contentious vaccination concerns can be in public contexts. And the feedback I got was, thank you for being neutral. Thank you for not being alarmist, from both sides, actually. And that made me feel gratified, because I feel like the gambit worked, right? Like what I had tried to succeed at in the book really did work in that way.
And I am caught myself, and I'll just explain, you know, my own difficulty with these issues. I have been vaccinated. I believe in the whole concept of herd immunity. And at the same time, I resist zero tolerance. I resist compulsion. I object to the mob mentality that the majority has used. And just most recently, there was a post in my Facebook feed from a woman I've known for 25 years. She is she has a doctorate in nursing. She teaches at the University of California. And she was demonizing Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and I just responded saying that I respect his right to hold unpopular views and to express them. And so some of this is a speech issue. Some of this is a personal choice issue, in my view. And I do not believe that compulsion or any form of zero tolerance will have the effect desired by the majority. And so I end up kind of caught between the two extreme poles here.
Right. And that's, I think that there are a lot of people in that particular position. And what I would say is that it helps to kind of, it helps to then take the issue of vaccination, at least the way I look at it, outside of specific attempts to solve certain kinds of problems. Because a lot of times when I'm interviewed, people will say, well, what do you think about schools where, you know, a large percentage of children have exemptions from vaccination? Or what do you think we should be doing to persuade more people to vaccinate? And what I always try to do is I always try to reframe that, those sets of questions, that my work is not about adjudicating what we should or should not be doing, but my approach is to understand how it is that people come to believe different things and how it is we might communicate with one another about those different things and find some common ground, whereupon I think some of the solutions to the problems that we see facing us will become more apparent.
And Professor, let's talk a little bit about, first of all, the importance of vaccination, and that we have seen some communicable diseases, serious ones like polio, virtually removed from the planet. I remember, growing up and being among the first to receive the Salk and Sabin vaccines. And that dates me. You can calculate from
right.
there. I've had tetanus shots and I've had typhoid shots. I watched my mother suffer through a bout of typhoid fever. And I said, whoa, I don't want that. And so we do have to acknowledge that, over the long haul and in the big picture, that vaccination is a powerful way of defending humans from communicable disease.
Yes, and I support that view. I think what's interesting about it now is the question of whether or not vaccination is an answer to all instances of infectious disease. So one of the big contentious things that happened in the late 20th century was, well, actually, it really happened not too late. It happened in the 1960s when after the two polio vaccines, the Salk and the Sabin vaccines, were approved, pharmaceutical companies turned their eye towards mumps, measles, and rubella, which were considered mild diseases of childhood at the time. And so parents needed, so the measles vaccine, for example, was approved in 1963. And so what you had was medical establishment and public health then needing to convince parents that these sort of routine ritualized illnesses of childhood really needed a vaccine to prevent them. Now, I'm not going to argue whether or not, I'm not going to argue that they are or are not mild diseases. That's not what I'm trying to do. But historically, they were experienced as such by families. And this, you know, this problem later rehearses itself in the 1990s when the chickenpox vaccine is approved and widely disseminated and then required for school entry in the later 1990s in most states. So you have this question about the adding vaccines to the infant and child schedule, the adding of them to the school entry mandates, and then parental concerns about the number of vaccines that children get.
And that menu is now up to 25 in the first 5 years of life. Is that accurate?
You know, it's hard to keep track, and some of it depends on, you know, some of it depends on whether your child goes to daycare or not. So, for example, rotavirus vaccine, I believe in some states, is required for entry to daycare, but that's time limited. You know, there's a certain, if your child can age out of that, need to get that particular vaccine. So, but yeah, it's quite a few, right? And multiple boosters. And so you end up with this, you end up with a set of concerns that, well, the way I put it is there may be a social limit, you know, so medicine, public health argue that there is no There's no biological limit at this point in terms of there's no evidence for immunological overload. There's no evidence that children get too many vaccines too early from the mainstream perspective. But one of the things that I suggest is that there may be a social limit to how many vaccines parents are going to tolerate for their children. And also whether or not, you know, that there's a very strong sensibility among some vaccine-resistant communities that illness is good for the body. Illness prepares the body for future health. It strengthens the body. There are some educational theories that argue that illness sort of prepares the child for kind of a blast of development after recovery. And so there's a strong sense that eradication of illness is not necessarily a good thing for human societies.
Well, and, you know, there are many alternative approaches that people embrace to medicine, to health and wellness. And many of these are positive and I think have few downsides. And, you know, people who opt out of a meat diet, I think are generally better, have better health prospects than people like me who are still carnivorous. And,
right.
And so it's very difficult to set up some sort of an evaluative system to say, well, these are approved alternative health, diet, and wellness regimes, and these are not. And we also have to deal with failures of the media, failures of the government, and occasional failures of science, where people who either had a bad result from the H1N1 flu virus, or people who felt that they got a flu shot that didn't have any impact because the researchers or the lab people didn't pick the right formula for that particular flu season. So, you know, depending on their personal experiences, the attitudes that they've developed from their own lives and from received information from parents and others in the, you know, extended family, peculiarities or illnesses that run in a family that lead people to say, well, you know, so-and-so got a vaccination, had a bad reaction, and that's all I need to know. So the variety of the levels of scientific validity and the emotional connections that people have to their views really produce a wide range of people who hold attitudes that aren't quite part of the majority.
Yes, and I mean, evidence shows that people place a lot of trust in alternative medical practices. There's a lot of money that is spent on alternative medical treatments, everything from supplements to acupuncture to massage therapy. I think you hit on, you know, some really interesting issues, and one is the question of trust. And how much trust do we place in our own experience? How much trust do we place in expert strangers who nevertheless make decisions that affect our lives? And one of the things that I think a lot about across many of my publications and my academic scholarship is how modern social systems, which force us to place a lot of trust in expert strangers. I mean, you know, airplane flying is one of the most common examples of this, right? The number of people we do not know whom we rely on to get us safely from one place to another, there's a lot of tension there when it comes to healthcare, right? How do we trust the systems in place, the licensure systems, the research protocols, pharmaceutical companies that are in charge of doing the studies to both license and approve vaccines, and then the federal advisory committees at both the FDA and the Centers for Disease Control that license and then also recommend the vaccines. You know, those are people we don't know. Those are people who have interests that may be different from our own. And this kind of push-pull from the personal to those expert strangers that we rely on, there's tension there. And that tension emerges in vaccination controversy.
And many people have just a broad-based skepticism of the pharmaceutical industry. It's profiteering. The whole model, leaves people feeling, well, this isn't about public health. This is about profits derived from science. And, here in San Francisco, we wrangled with the HIV/AIDS epidemic through the 1980s and until the mid-90s when the therapies were developed. But those same companies were saying, well, you know, there's not a big enough market here. And, that led to a whole lot of antagonism with not only the gay community, but those of us who support it at the height of the epidemic. And so, you know, there are many long-running and deep-seated either fears or attitudes that people have about the industry that brings us these vaccines.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge, and distrust goes way back, even before there were really large pharmaceutical companies. I had a group of students doing research on newspapers published in the United States between 1915 and 1922, looking for how vaccines and vaccination were represented at the time. And of course, there were very few vaccines then. And one of the things that came through was a sort of distrust at that time of doctors who were purveyors of vaccines, that somehow, smallpox vaccines, for example, that doctors were profiting, and especially profiting if when the vaccines were, diluted or they had contamination, things like that. And so this notion that medicine as a profession and then the pharmaceutical industry basically profiteering. It has a long history in vaccine concern.
And one of the arguments raised by RFK Jr. that I have heard him say on several occasions is that the Congress has essentially immunized the industries that create vaccines. And as I understand it, if they, in the fine print disclosures that nobody reads, if they acknowledge that a side effect could include, atrophy or organ failure or even death, they are then, legally protected from claims. They are indemnified, as I understand it, if they disclose a possible dangerous side effect in the literature that accompanies the release of the vaccine.
So this was accomplished in the 1980s, and there's both a rationale for it and a consequence. So the rationale is that vaccines are administered to millions of people every year, right? Entire birth cohorts are vaccinated, and as a result, there's an acknowledgement in public health. I mean, any responsible public health officer or physician will say there is no vaccine that is completely risk-free. As a result, there are going to be adverse consequences, and a few of them, obviously very rarely, will be very serious. And as a result, Congress was worried that at the time that there would be that pharmaceutical companies would simply go out of the vaccine business if there was not some kind of liability protection, given that the population level of administration of vaccines. And so they passed the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Act, I believe it was called. It established the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. So there's a tax on every vaccine administered in this country that is then put into basically a big account that then pays out for decisions by the vaccine court when there is an established and demonstrated injury from a vaccine. So from the public health side, this was a necessary legal action to ensure strong industry participation in national vaccine programs. From the other side, it looks like an attempt to give very wealthy pharmaceutical companies a free pass when there's a problem. And so there tends to be then a perception from vaccine resistant folks that there's this you know kind of collusion between government and pharmaceutical companies around vaccine injury. Vaccine resistors tend to believe that there's far more vaccine injury in the public than is acknowledged by the CDC or medicine more generally.
And this is the first time I've heard of vaccine court. It's not presided over by Judge Judy, I hope.
No. It's called a special master court. There's actually a book written by Anna Kirkland about the vaccine court and its development. Mm-hmm. There was a famous case in the 2000s. There was a case of a girl named Hannah Pauling, who was in fact determined to have contracted a neurodevelopmental disease syndrome from a vaccination because she had a rare mitochondrial disorder. So that tends to be the case that is brought up by people who still believe that there is a connection between vaccines and autism. But it was the same court, for example, in 2009 in the omnibus autism proceeding that demonstrated there was no linkage between MMR vaccine and thimerosal and autism. And so, but that court does adjudicate cases of vaccine injury. There was, before they stopped using the oral polio vaccine in this country, there were very, very rarely cases of polio that were caused by that vaccine. Mm-hmm. It's a federal court with a special master. And if you can look all this stuff up online and there'll be lots of information on it.
So, Professor, concerns were raised, as you just alluded, about thimerosal, which I believe has elements of mercury in it. Mm-hmm. And this was the carrier. The vaccine is a virus, right? And so it has to be maintained in some sort of a you help me out here. You're the
okay. So the thimerosal is actually a preservative, and it's a very old preservative. It's ethyl mercury. And so the thimerosal was used only in vials of vaccines that had multiple doses in them, right? So that a needle would be going in and out, right? Although you would obviously use a sterile needle each time. And so thimerosal was in some vaccines, but not all vaccines. And I believe it is still in some multi-dose vials of flu vaccine, but those are not used in this country. I believe that's true, but I'm not like 100% sure of that. But it has been removed from all children's vaccines. So the concern with thimerosal was that with a mercury derivative in it, that this could be a cause of neurological problems in children. Thimerosal was never in MMR vaccine, which was identified in the late 1990s as being linked to cases of autism, but that linkage has been debunked in the article that was produced and published in The Lancet in 1998 by Andrew Wakefield has been retracted. In addition, there have been subsequent studies that have not demonstrated a link between either thimerosal or the MMR vaccine and autism. Nevertheless, within vaccine dissenting communities, there continues to be a persistent belief in the connection between vaccines and either autism or other neurodegenerative disorders. Mm-hmm. And those beliefs are extremely persistent. It is based, I believe, on parental observation and experience and the lack of any other explanatory system to understand why we have so many cases of diagnosed autism in children these days.
And so do you see this as, parents who overdose on Google searches and they find information and can't let go of it? I am persuaded that, the purported linkage between vaccines and autism has not been proven scientifically. But I think, as you point out, the fears persist. And, I do have great compassion for parents who are confronted with these choices and who are acting on the information that they place belief in.
So I think that the question is, how do we understand the responsibility of parents in managing, maintaining, and optimizing the health of their children? So when we go to the doctor, or even when we watch the morning news programs on TV and they have a report on some illness or some treatment or another, practically every single time they end those news reports, the famous doctor who's on the television screen will say, "But don't take my word for it. Do your homework. Get more information." And yet, when we do look for information, when we try to get more information about things that concern us about either our own health or our children's health, if the information that we get is somehow perceived not to be authoritative in medicine's eyes, then we're criticized. So there is a problem with the democratic opportunities for information seeking online. But I think that if we kind of take a step back from the specific instance and we look at the situation in general, we can sort of see that it's a question of how responsible are parents supposed to be about their children's health? Does this extend to making decisions about vaccination, which are not a personal health issue but are a public health issue, and therefore in many ways the decisions are made for us by the state? How should we articulate our concerns when we believe that a medical procedure has injured either ourselves or our children? And what are the ways in which we use all of our information networks to educate ourselves about things that concern us?
We're talking with Bernice L. Hausman, Hausman. Her new book is Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. And Professor, Chapter 6 in your book really sung to me, and you floored me by opening with a reference to Kellyanne Conway.
Well, it seemed like if I was going to talk about the status of facts, I needed to refer to alternative facts, which have become an internet meme in our current period. I do believe it, that I, at one point in that introductory section to the chapter, mentioned that it is distasteful to agree with Kellyanne Conway.
Well, allow me to quote, because I bent the page back and highlighted this. "As unappealing as it is to even appear to come to the defense of Kellyanne Conway, I feel it necessary to state that there have always been alternative facts."
Yeah. So, I mean, really, a lot of the book really came down to this sort of question of how do we handle in a democracy the fact that people believe different things? It's kind of fundamental to how democracies work. Now, I do think that we are in a time when we've lost a sense that there can be a consensus about the objective factual nature of the world, because of the sort of political spin that is put on many, many things. But I think that that chapter, what it tries to do is suggest in a more generous way than has been offered previously with respect to vaccine dissent, an understanding of why people reject scientific facts that others hold to be true, based on the sense that they feel that they're not disinterested, that they have interest or bias inherent in them, and that it's not possible to remove facts from the cultural context in which they're produced.
And let me quote from later in the chapter, even modern facts are problems for many of us when the broad systematic scope of statistical generalization does not cohere with what we have experienced as reality. Now, can I unpack that?
Yeah. Well, so
that's when the data don't apply to me.
Yeah. Well, so this is a huge problem in medicine because there is, rightly a belief that medical treatments need to be evidence-based. I think we all would agree that we would like to know that the treatments that our doctors prescribe for us have been demonstrated to work. But the circumstances that provide the best evidence, right, the randomized controlled trial, tend to strip away the specifics of people's identities and experience, right, and focus solely on sort of very, very generalizable factors. And in medicine, sometimes an individual physician's clinical experience, in other words, that physician's experience prescribing drugs or treatments to specific patients that he or she has known for years, differs from the evidence coming out of randomized controlled trials. So what do you do? Medicine I think of medicine as, the best way to talk about it would be like a technical craft in which the physician is a kind of an artist in drawing on experience, drawing on knowledge, some of which is scientific and some of which is sociological, in understanding how to deal with, treat, and relate to specific patients. So what do you do when your own clinical experience differs from the evidence coming out of randomized controlled trials? So that's a big question in medicine today. And that's what I'm trying to talk about in that instance, that facts are actually produced in different kinds of circumstances. Some of them are produced in randomized controlled trials, but we also produced facts empirically as we live our lives daily and we make causal connections between one thing and another.
Let's see, I'm looking here at some of my marginal notes here. I wanted to raise the issue again when we talk about trust. It pains me that university researchers are now able to own patents and then form startup companies that can lead to massive fortunes for them. And this seems to be a fundamental conflict of interest to me, the opportunity to generate profits and then to, steer the rollout of a newly developed medication to maximize the profits, not necessarily to advance the academic institution's values, which would be to, make people more healthy.
So are you suggesting that you're against capitalism?
In some forms, I am, yeah.
Well, this sort of drive toward entrepreneurship this is sort of putting on a different hat of mine, but that's a huge element of contemporary academia.
It sure is.
In part because there's always, when that happens, there's always an arrangement between the researcher and the institution about some kind of profit sharing. But it is also about stature. It's about, and it's about the future of funding streams that come into the institution based on previous success, both to the individual investigator and to others. So that's, talking about that issue is a little bit beyond my pay grade beyond my areas of expertise. But I think it goes back to this issue, as you pointed out, it's an issue of trust. Like, who are the people who are creating and then profiting from medications generally, and then more specifically, vaccines? A good example of this would be the 2006 rollout of the Gardasil vaccine, which is made by Merck. And it's a vaccine to prevent human papillomavirus, mm-hmm. which is a sexually transmitted disease that can lead to cervical cancer in women and then other cancers, head and neck cancers, as well as other penile anal cancers, things like that. When it was rolled out, there was Merck actually was involved in a very aggressive campaign to try to convince states to add the vaccine to its school entry requirements for middle schoolers. And a lot of people recoiled from that. Now, because from the perspective of the company, right, if you can get a vaccine mandated, you're going to have a much higher rate of acceptance than you would if it's not required for school entry. And so that was really seen suspiciously as an attempt to boost profit margins for a very expensive vaccine.
So, Professor, one of the features of your book is that you cite a number of comments and verbatim quotes from people who are described as vaccine resistors or skeptics. And this came out of the project, the Vaccination Research Group, that you started at Virginia Tech. Share with us a few of the comments that you think are salient, because your book really does, I think, help the pro-vaccination people develop some understanding of why others resist.
So we conducted two small interview studies and they were not entirely of vaccine resistors, but they were populated largely by vaccine resistors. And there were a number of themes that emerged from those studies that I include in my discussion in the book. One is the importance of nutrition for health and the belief that good nutrition is a foundational element of health, of personal health practices. And there was one person that we interviewed who had a comment about how terrible it is in hospitals that people recovering from surgery are given Jell-O to help give them a little bit of some calories as they're in recovery. And she just is like, that's like an empty food. Give them some bone broth, something with substance. And I thought about that comment quite a bit when my mother was in the hospital and at the end of her life, she had a gastric bleed and she was on a liquid diet and she was given this sort of Jell-O. And I kept thinking, there's a woman who spent 5 days, 89-year-old woman who spent 5 days without eating. And she was extremely weak when she left the hospital. And if she'd been given something more nutritious, maybe, you know, her health would not have been so terrible. And at the very end, in addition, there's this sort of focus on nutrition. It's a focus on the belief in illness, a belief in the power of illness that here's a quotation I think that's pretty good that kind of encapsulates some of these views. I think that if you're healthy, you probably won't get sick as often, but you're able to handle it. And I think specifically with children, getting sick is an important part of being a child. It's kind of like use it or lose it with your immune system. And I think how people won't let their kids be ill is causing a lot of the chronic illness epidemic that's happening. People's immune system, it's kind of like your muscles. If you don't use them, they're just going to become noodles. I think your immune system's the same way.
And you summarize some of the key points under a bullet point list here. What bothers people about vaccines? And I'll just pick a few. It's page 197.
Yeah.
Lived experience with illness, especially illness that is not effectively treated by mainstream medicine. Protection of the body and control over what goes into the body. Experience with perceived vaccine injury. Distrust of mainstream scientific studies of vaccine safety. Perception that too many vaccines are given routinely to children. Rejection of one-size-fits-all prescription of vaccine mandates, belief that parental responsibility for child health care involves deliberative decision-making about vaccinations, and perception of children as persons with rights over their bodies. That's just about half of your list there, but I think it does offer a sampling of the attitudes that people hold. And later in the book, before you kind of cast aside your objective stance. You say, as I have argued, promoting science and its data in favor of vaccination does not create trusting vaccinators out of skeptics, at least not the ones we have spoken to, even though most of the people we've interviewed are not full-on vaccine refusers. And this, I think, is the most important takeaway for the pro-vaccine majority, which often, in my view, operates like an angry mob and treats those who dissent as idiots, as threats to their own health and welfare, and as people they would like to vote off the island.
Well, I think that one of the things that continues to startle me is the tenor of the debate and how inflammatory it is, how angry. I mean, I published an op-ed piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer last March about the measles outbreaks in this country, and it was reading the comments section was kind of horrifying. I think that the part of the problem is this vilifying atmosphere in which it's okay to sort of lob these sort of terrible accusations at other people because of their beliefs, and some of that. I mean, one of the early chapters in the book, I show that this inflammatory kind of tone in news reporting, you can track it. You can track it developing in the 1990s, but really taking hold after 2000s.
And can I submit here from the 14th of November, I printed out an article from The Guardian. That's a British newspaper. Majority of anti-vax ads on Facebook are funded by just two organizations, reads the headline. The opening sentence, the majority of Facebook ads spreading misinformation about vaccines are funded by two organizations, and then they name Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s World Mercury Project and Stop Mandatory Vaccinations run by Larry Cook. And, I feel that the bias in the very first sentence here, saying that those who are critical of vaccination or who want to raise concerns about it are spreading misinformation. Now, some of that may be true, but I believe that in particular, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., while he has been strong and aggressive in his actions and in his language, I don't believe he has spread misinformation. If so, I haven't found it.
So what I would say is that, you know, it's not that there isn't misinformation about vaccine dangers. It isn't that people aren't misled by others or internet sites that are less than credible. It's that the misinformation frame keeps us in a register where teaching facts and discrediting are the primary methods of rectifying vaccine hesitancy. So we then miss the point of people's concerns, right? We miss the point of what worries them. We allow ourselves to think about other people as necessarily more gullible, less smart, and less literate in scientific understanding than we are. And I think I'm really concerned about the sort of misinformation-information dichotomy that has been created, because it's too simplistic a frame for what is really going on.
And Professor, finally, as we wrap up, I want to talk about something that I didn't find much about in the book, and that is regulatory approaches to compulsory vaccination. And here in California, we've had a long-running debate, and it is prompted by a medical doctor, a pediatrician who serves in the state Senate, Richard Pan. And he has advanced legislation to eliminate any kind of exemptions. And I credit California Governor Newsom, who took it on the chin from the pro-vax crowd when he held up the legislation and demanded some changes to it to allow at least some exemptions. And I support Governor Newsom on this. I think that he came up with an intelligent compromise that does respect the rights of the minority here. And, for example, I've got a clipping here in right now in Germany, parents are being told that they must vaccinate their children against measles or face fines of several thousand euros. That's a new law that was just passed and will take effect next March. So what is your view of compulsory vaccination?
It's very interesting developments this year, because we have, you know, burgeoning measles outbreaks all around the world. And I will say that the outbreaks in the United States have, to this date, been handily contained within the communities in which they originally emerged. And so the number of cases that we have in this country pales in comparison to what's going on in Ukraine, for example, the Philippines, Madagascar, Congo, and even other areas of Europe. So we are seeing around the world increases in measles. And so one of the responses now, in some ways taking off from the success of vaccine mandates in the United States in bolstering vaccination rates, is increasing vaccine mandates. So there's an active and very interesting academic conversation about the effect of mandates on both on vaccination rates and on the political context. Historically, as I understand it, historically the mandates have been they've been utilized as kind of a pressure valve, or the exemption rules, so that if you have a mandate for school entry but you have relatively easy exemption opportunities, then you sort of dispel the dissent that occurs when some people don't want to vaccinate their children. So you kind of create a context in which you kind of can better control sort of political dissent around vaccine mandates by allowing those who really don't want to vaccinate to have an out. So I think we're going to see in this country, as we've seen this year, New York State ended its non-medical exemptions to vaccines. There was a law passed in Maine that will take effect, I believe, in 2021 to end non-medical exemptions. I believe Washington State ended non-medical exemptions for the MMR vaccine. And then, of course, California in 2015 passed House Bill 277, which changed ended non-medical exemptions in California for most people. And so I think that it'll be very interesting to see what happens with vaccination controversy and political dissent around vaccination after this, and whether or not these laws increase rates of vaccination or end the sort of clustering of under-vaccinated people. Because for example, New York, which had a lot of cases of measles in those two ultra-Orthodox communities, New York has high measles vaccination rate. And so, so what is the marginal gain going to be versus the political cost? I think we'll be able to see that in real time.
I also believe that when you link it to public school enrollment, that many parents who feel strongly about this will homeschool or, look for a private school or some other way of making an end run on the government mandate.
So there is some evidence in California that is exactly what has happened. So since California's more strict vaccination mandate law was passed, there have been an increase in the number of medical exemptions for vaccines and an increase in the number of children homeschooled, I believe. There was an interesting article published recently in Pediatrics, which is the official journal of the American the American Academy of Pediatrics, and arguing that very little of the increase in vaccination rates in California can be connected to the new law, that it really was can be attributed to the tightening up of existing restrictions, making sure that children who had a contingent admission to school were being vaccinated, and some other areas. I think we're going to see what the effect of this idea of tightening vaccine mandates is on both vaccination rates and on public sentiment. And I think, again, it goes back to sort of these questions around democracy, what happens when people believe different things, and what are the right mechanisms to ensure strong public health initiatives in this country. And I'm not sure that forcing people to do things they think is dangerous for themselves and their children, really dangerous, is always the right thing to do.
Professor, this has been a great conversation. Is there anything you'd like to add that I didn't ask you about?
I don't think so. I think you read the book very closely and really covered pretty much everything.
Well, I think you did an incredible job and have really, I think, advanced understanding of the resistors and skeptics. And I hope that the people who are part of the majority herd will open their minds and read your book, because there has been this kind of really condescending majority smugness that, we've got the answers here, and anybody who is a dissenter is just somehow defective.
So I have a post-it note on my computer. I'm looking at it right now on my monitor, and it says, "The Snide Attitude." And I wrote that after reading an article, and I don't remember what the article was, but I wrote that exactly about what you're just talking about. The snide attitude that vaccine dissenters are not only wrong, but really deficient in reasoning, highly gullible, all of the sort of vilified things that are inflammatory things that are said about them, that this snide attitude that vaccination is always the best and only way to approach infectious disease. So
the book is Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. My thanks to Bernice L. Hausman.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Professor Bernice Hausman. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails.